Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Ghouls in the House. I'm Arnold T. Blumberg.
And I'm Natalie Litovsky.
And this is our 50th episode.
Ta-da!
And because it's a special episode, we decided to pick one specific movie that you hold very close to your heart and that has become an all-time favorite of mine as well. And it's a go-to, incredibly quotable, incredibly rewatchable film that, similar to other movies we love, has become a cult favorite with some and is virtually unknown by a lot of other people. And it's Drop Dead Gorgeous from 1999.
Sarah Rose knows you're a beautiful person. Sarah Rose knows you have an unusual talent. Sarah Rose knows you're a teenage girl. And she definitely knows that you are ready for the ultimate in teen glamour. The American Teen Princess Pageant.
And I am here to argue that it is in fact a slasher as opposed to a dark comedy, which is how it is typically built.
Exactly. And although we would have talked about it anyway, that's why it fits our show so well.
Indeed.
Is that it is definitely also a horror movie, a horror comedy, in addition to other things. And I'll talk about the first time that I realized that. But it's similar to when we did like a focus on Death to Smoochie and a few other things. I can't fathom why Drop Dead Gorgeous isn't more popular, well-known. But it does seem like it is very popular if you're someone that knows it.
So here's the thing. I, not being as steeped in sort of the business of film as you are, am constantly surprised when you tell me that movies I love that I always thought were super popular just completely, like, bombed at the box office. And this is one of them. This is one of those movies that apparently did not do well and was just not well regarded. And I never knew that because I bought the DVD from like the just buy the movies out of the discount bin at Blockbuster when I was in college. And I bought it based solely on the cover alone of the original DVD, which I still own and will never get rid of because the art on it is way better than anything they've ever released since. But I never knew that it was like a cult movie because I loved it so much and my brain never thought, you should check and see if other people know about this, because I just assumed everyone loved it because it's fantastic.
It's bizarre to me. I never saw it until I saw it with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I forget how much you told me ahead of time before we sat down to watch it.
But full spoilers, by the way.
Yeah, full spoilers, as usual. But I don't remember what exactly you told me in advance, but obviously I knew like there are some people in it I know, like Kirsten Dunst and Amy Adams. Amy Adams in one of her...
Brittany Murphy?
Earliest parts. Brittany Murphy. Yeah, it's always tragic seeing Brittany Murphy and how incredibly talented she was. And yeah, so that, and of course, like powerhouse stuff from Alice and Janney is maybe the best thing I ever seen Alice and Janney do.
Ever.
We'll be right behind you in the hearse, okay?
Don't let that worry you, Annette.
And Ellen Barkin, and unfortunately Kirstie Alley, but despite the fact that she was a right-wing nut job, we can't deny the fact that she plays a villain really well in this. But then again, she's good for that.
Yeah, and by all accounts, they hated her on the set.
Yes. So it sounds like there's...
makes it feel good. Denise Richards, by the way.
It sounds
mentioned.
Like that's pretty consistent.
It's just, this is a heck of a who's who. Mindy Sterling. It's like, it's quite a who's who cast in this
Will
movie.
Will Sasso popping up.
Mm-hmm.
Adam West popping up.
Very briefly.
And perfectly happy to have a joke told about him that makes him sound like a real creep. It's just like, we're going to refer to you as a real creep. Is that okay? That's fine, old chum.
The American Teen Princess Pageant provides personal growth, scholarship, travel.
And you might even meet a few celebrities. Yes.
Thomas Lennon is the voice of the documentarian. I should mention the style of this is that it's in the vague area of mockumentary, but not quite Spinal Tap, but sort of in the vein of it's a documentary, but it's a very dark satirical take on the world of beauty pageants, local beauty pageants.
Maybe what I should do is just give a brief like summary promo here. And if you've never seen this, after I tell you what it's about, you should probably go watch it and then come back and listen to the rest. Because the basic pitch for this is it's done mockumentary style, where a documentary crew decides to follow one specific town's pageant that is part of an entry into a larger teen pageant world sponsored by a makeup company, a fake brand they create for the movie. But the idea is it's sort of like a Miss Teen America kind of vibe, where every single small town can have a pageant committee, and then they'll go to the state level, and whoever wins the state level represents the state at like a nationally broadcast pageant that is sponsored by this makeup brand. So the documentary crew decides to go to the tiny, tiny town of Mount Rose, Minnesota. And you think, oh, okay, this is just going to be a weird slice of life, Midwestern thing. And then things just start going weirdly wrong in very extreme ways. And you start to realize that like this documentary crew is going to get way more than they bargained for as they film this pageant. And it just escalates from there, basically. But it's extraordinary how long it takes before you realize, oh, I think this is going to be a slasher movie. And it takes quite a while to kind of get into that. And you just sort of get immersed in the town and the characters and the world. And if you've never seen it, it can be very difficult to locate on streaming. A few years ago, it popped up on streaming. It was very exciting to find. You could just pull it up. There is, unfortunately, another movie from the 2000s called Drop Dead Gorgeous. And when you search for things, that's often what is actually available. Sometimes they put the wrong poster on it. So, you know, grain of salt when you go searching, but you can buy essentially a print on demand Blu-ray from like the Warner Home Collection. They just do very terrible box art and no special features, never been released with special features.
That's the thing too, given all the people involved in this, mm-hmm. and people like, you got Academy Award level stuff, you got Amy Adams, you got, there's no reason this shouldn't by now have been given a special edition and get everybody you can get before it's too late. I mean, again, I don't like her as a person, but Kirstie Alley is gone now.
Brittany Murphy is gone now.
Brittany Murphy is gone. There are a lot of people in this that are already gone. It's from an era where you wouldn't automatically think that was... Another one that strikes me that I'm looking at the cast list is she's got a very tiny part, but Patty Yatsutake is in this as the mother of one of the pageant girls who's white but has been adopted by a Japanese couple that are trying to assimilate into American society in a pretty much very inappropriate and probably problematic, but also very funny way. And Yatsutake's the mother, and she just died. And most people know her as Nurse Ogawa from Star Trek The Next Generation. And it was a sudden loss. So there are all these people that like we could talk to, and they're already gone. Talk to everyone else now and make a special edition.
Which doesn't exist. And if anyone who has control over anything listens to our podcast, which I am sure you don't, but if you do, please.
All the execs.
I will buy the special edition, like full of features and interviews, Blu-ray of this. And that should be motivation enough to make me happy and make this.
In fact, we might buy two.
Maybe, just in case. You don't know what's going to happen.
We'll buy two of them.
I already own the original DVD and this print-on-demand Blu-ray that I'm telling you to go get, which you can get for very cheap. You just go online. It's one of the things that they just stamp out the discs, like, as you order them.
Yeah.
Put it in a box with art that they've created that has nothing to do with the original box art and doesn't tell you anything about it, but doesn't matter. If you haven't seen it and you listen to this podcast, I promise you, you will like it. So just go buy the Blu-ray Sight Unseen. It's like less than $10 and watch it. Then come back and listen to the rest of this episode.
Okay, good. So now that you've seen it, And see, weren't we right? This was a really great movie. So now we're going to talk about it, and you'll know exactly what we're talking about. And I should mention that Natalie is wearing the shirt of the band today because she is wearing a shirt that says, I competed in the 1995 Sarah Rose Cosmetics America Teen Princess Pageant, and all I got was salmonella and dysentery. And see, you get that joke now because you just saw the movie.
Shout out to Super Yaki. That's where the shirt came from.
Didn't they do like a whole Drop Dead Gorgeous
collection? They did, except they do their releases as like limited releases, so you can't buy the shirt anymore. Otherwise, I'd put a link on the podcast so you could go buy it. But what we will put a link to is our own TeePublic page, where we have created design in like a varsity style where you can rep Mount Rose High School as if you went there, which is like my new favorite thing. We've done one for Drop Dead Gorgeous. We did one for Romeo and Michelle, and we did one for Scream. The just your standard high school name year shirts. So we have that on our shirt.
And I should mention, just to kick off, Mount Rose was based on the real Rosemount, which was where writer Lona Williams grew up. And so a lot of this is basically her ode to her hometown, I guess. And I wanted to make a mention of the people involved in this, because the movie is an intersection of talent that, based on things we both know from before and after, makes perfect sense why we both appreciate the tone of this and what it does. Lona Williams is really the creator of the film.
And she, I love her voice.
And she appears very briefly in a, like, she never gets a line. But
she's one of the judges.
Yeah, she always looks
miserable. If you've watched the film, Gene Kanga, the judge who looks miserable and never speaks, is actually the creator of this whole film.
And in her very short filmography, she also did the 2001 movie Sugar and Spice,
which I love and never realized was also her, which apparently also bombed and is also just a wonderful, weird, biting satire filled with people whose careers were about to take off. So she's a star maker.
And apart from writing additional dialogue for the 2004 movie Shark Tale, the only other movie on her filmography is she wrote the story for 2015's Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse,
which we also love and are going to do an episode on.
And then directing it is Michael Patrick Jan, who's one of the members of The State, which explains why Tom Lennon is there doing the voice of the documentary filmmaker who we never see. He's off camera. But Jan is one of the ones that, while appearing on camera, has done a lot of directing of Reno 911 and a lot of the other stuff. But it really, given Reno 911, it really shows you he's got down the idea of that lunacy that comes from a documentary experience of people.
And this is sort of a precursor to it, in a sense.
Absolutely. And then I was just looking, there are so many people we've already mentioned who are in this, who are on the cusp of extraordinary stardom or in the midst of it. And we've already listed a lot of them, but of the main girls that we follow, we've got Kirsten Dunst, we've got Denise Richards, Amy Adams, of course, Brittany Murphy we mentioned, and there are a few that didn't go on to the same level of fame.
But it still worked or contributed in some way.
So of them, I just wanted to mention, since all of them are wonderful in this, and all of them create incredible characters, that Laurie Sinclair is Michelle Johnson, and I love her character because she does her, she's the one who does her talent bit as a scene from Soylent Green. That was one of the things that won me over.
Well, her interpretation.
Her interpretation. She's currently going by the name Ryrie Sinclair, and she's a musician now. Mm-hmm. She doesn't act anymore much, but she's done tons of music for Vampire Diaries, Law and Order, Disney. Like, she does music for
the business.
Television mainly, and she's done a lot of that. Then we've got Shannon Nelson is Tess Winehouse, and she's the one
whose talent is dog calls.
Whose dog calls. And she doesn't act much anymore, but I couldn't find much else about her. Sarah Stewart is Janelle. Sarah Stewart is Janelle, and she's the one that does the sign language. And she also doesn't work that much anymore. I couldn't find much. But the other interesting one is Molly.
who was adopted by the Japanese couple.
Tara Redpenning. She is now a licensed medical mental health counselor. And she's does a lot of work in like finding your zen and handling stress and everything and reducing the stigma of mental illness. And that's her whole thing now. I mean, she totally got out of
working acting. As an actor probably gives you insights into the necessity of that.
So I just thought it'd be interesting look at a few of the others, because some, like Kirsten Dunst, obviously, we know where they wound up.
Yeah, I mean, and Kirsten Dunst already had a successful
career.
Denise Richards already did at that point.
But I'll tell you when I first realized I was watching a slasher movie, kind of. So the movie is, right from the outset, it's funny. It kicks off immediately with like an ad for the Sarah Rose pageant with Adam West doing it, because apparently he had officiated, and we find out took advantage of his job as officiant in ways that make him look terrible. And apparently, like I said earlier, he was just fine with, because he's crazy. So like I thought, okay, I got this. This is this kind of movie, and documentary style, I love that. When it works really well, mockumentary style is great. But then, like a little ways in, we've got one of the girls who is Brooke Bushman, who plays Tammy, and she's very butch. And
I love that too. It's like such amazing representation. Yeah. Where she's even like, because basically they're kind of interviewing the pageant committee, they're interviewing the town like dignitaries and the mayor. Now they're
getting to know everybody.
Get to know everybody. And now they're going to interview all the girls, find out a little bit about them. And they get to Tammy's interview, and she's got her like varsity letter jacket on. And clearly Tammy is a jock.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Tammy's a sports person, but Tammy is also really bright and like really competitive. And she arguably is giving the best like interview to the documentarians. It's really focused and talking a lot about winning and how it's important. And like, you know, she loves her varsity letters. And, you know, a lot of people say, hey, like, how can I win a pageant? But, you know, they didn't think I'd beat out Becky Lehman there for president of the Lutheran Sisterhood Gun Club, but I beat her at that. So I'd say, hey, man, I could do this.
And while we're watching the end of her interview segment, we're getting the standard B-roll of her on the farm riding a tractor, because apparently that's what she's doing in her regular day, except that it then immediately ends the scene with her tractor blowing up.
And cuts right from that hard cut to her funeral and a table full of Jell-O salads.
And it was at that moment that I thought, oh, wait a minute, this is also a slasher movie. And yes, someone is killing off, or trying to, all of the contestants. And wouldn't you know it, it's all in favor, more or less, of the aforementioned Becky Lehman, who's Denise Richards, and Kirstie Alley's daughter.
And Kirstie Alley just happens to be the pageant organizer. So, you know.
Shout out also to the incredibly wonderful character actor Sam McMurray, who always brings 110% as being usually a total sleazebag in anything he's in. And he's their Kirstie Alley's husband and Becky's father, Lester.
And he does not disappoint as a sleazebag in this.
No. Racist and awful.
Misogynist.
And misogynist. And yet also apparently a devoted husband and father to some extent.
Because it's clear that he's a terrible human being and a complete moron. And also just, you know, real proud of his daughter and like his wife, who I guess is sort of the pick of the town.
And more proud of his drinks cart that's shaped like a world globe that you can open, which he's really happy about. And yeah, so, and then as things continue, as you were saying more subtly before we had everybody go watch the movie, it really starts escalating. And I was like, okay, there's a lot of threads happening here. It's incredibly funny. It's incredibly sharply written. All the characters are interesting and great. And so well, everybody is doing such a great job creating a full character. Even down to like Will Sasso. Like there are some things where it's like the humor could be, Sasso's playing an idiot. And it's such an easy thing to do in some ways. Like he's just being a big doofus. But I would argue even his character is very layered. Like you get to know a little about the fact that he, how he gets sad, like, you know, the relationship with his brother and his brother, right?
His yeah. And by the way, his brother, if you are an elder millennial as I am, you will recognize his brother in this as the same actor who played Professor Keenbean in the Macaulay Culkin Richie Rich movie. And I may have also subjected Arnold here to the Macaulay Culkin Richie Rich movie so that he could understand the nature of my childhood.
And we will start moving into the world of Harvey Comics cinema in our next episode.
But we will, actually. I didn't mean to make that segue, yeah, but there we go.
That's Mike McShane, who yeah, also is the therapist at the beginning of Office Space that basically gives him his zen and dies of a heart attack. Great, also great character. Everybody in this.
Everybody is
an incredible cast. You will recognize so many people that, you know, are in that second and third string sometimes, people that never necessarily get huge. And
the people where you're like, oh, I recognize that guy from that thing, yes, that time.
Fully rounded characters, including people that probably wish they didn't do such a good job. I still love the fact actor Matt Malloy still does interviews where he talks about the fact that as John Doe, D-O-U-G-H, one of the judges of the beauty pageant, who's clearly there because he appreciates teen girls a lot more than he should. He often talks about how people still accost him on the street for being...
They think he's a creep for real, yeah, because they can't separate it from the movie. Yeah. There was a, I think it was a Vanity Fair or someone did a big...
The oral history
Yeah,
stuff.
Like an yeah, oral history of Drop Dead Gorgeous a few years ago for like an anniversary. And they interviewed him and he said like, he'll be walking through the mall and people will be like, oh, like, he's that guy who's too into the teen girls. And like he's like, no. It's a movie. I'm an actor. That was a character in the movie.
He does it so well.
But he really does do it well.
Yeah, it's awesome. And
I especially like the, you've got a camera. Nobody's accusing you of anything.
And it's like nuance too. Everybody is doing incredible work down to like just little expressions in the side. There are movies where people, you can actually watch sometimes people tune out if they're not the focus of a scene.
Right.
And then once you see that, you can never unsee that. I never really see that happen in any scene in this movie. Everybody is really invested. And I think at the very top, at the peak of it all, and I think really to me, like the star of the movie is Allison Janney as Loretta, who's the
Loretta's
close friend.
Loretta's my hero.
She is the close friend of Kirsten Dunst is our lead, really, is Amber Atkins, who we're really, she's the one they're most profiling.
She's our POV character.
Yeah. And she wants to win. She wants to become Diane Sawyer one day. And her mother is Ellen Barkin, Annette, and they live in a trailer home. And it's, you know, very cliched in a certain respect.
Her mom runs a salon out of their living room.
And then Allison Janney is their friend, Loretta, who in many ways functions as a second mother, because mm-hmm, there's absent men in their life, which is probably a good thing given the circumstances. And it really seems like they are incredibly close and she's probably co-parented. It seems like all of Amber's life.
Probably, yeah.
But she is such a free spirit and so...
Sex positive
and positive about everything. And she's just fantastic. And the Midwest accents in this are just on point.
Would love to watch, like, you know, they keep bringing like series to fruition that branch off of movies that nobody needs. Like, you just don't need like the sub characters of like some Disney thing that happened, or I know like haters on the internet, but like another Walking Dead spinoff is just not necessary.
Hey, here's two whole seasons of characters that are eventually going to become charcoal briquettes. You want that? Apparently a lot of people do.
I don't know.
We don't.
What I want is a TV show that just steps back into the lives of Annette and Loretta, and I just want a sitcom that just follows them. That's it. Just let them live their lives and I will watch it on TV.
That would work really well today. Both of them still around. Ellen Barkin just did that Poker Face, the first season.
Allison Janney, I think, just finished up with Mom. Yeah. They come after a bazillion years.
And it would be great because you wouldn't need Kirsten Dunst because she's off doing her news and everything. Although if they could manage like a season finale cameo, that would probably be something they would want to do.
Or you really want to make it fish out of water, you get that Kirsten Dunst has done well in her news career and she's moved Annette and Loretta to like New York or Chicago LA or something.
That makes a lot of sense.
And it's basically absolutely fabulous, but it's Annette and Loretta.
That's an awesome idea.
Call me, Hollywood. Hello. Hi, I'm here. Ideas aplenty, just rolling around.
Let's just say who should win. Who deserves to win is Amber.
Why don't you just paint a big old target on your ass?
Best damn tapper. The most smartest.
Most smartest?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. You're real educated. Like, most smartest. Get a picture of that. Most smartest.
Most smartest.
Come on. Come on.
I should also mention, Mindy Sterling's the one from Austin Powers.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
She does, honestly, some of my favorite background business that I have ever seen in a movie ever. Where they're sitting in the school gym and Kirstie Alley is just talking about the pageant and the importance of it and how it's good for the girls. And Mindy Sterling is behind her eating a piece of cake, like pound cake or something like that. But rather than eat it with a fork or eat it with her fingers, she takes a little piece of it, crumbles it between her fingers, and then touches the crumbs to the tip of her tongue. And it's so intentional. And it's this such amazing testament to her skills as like an improv actor that she can do that in the background. And my eyeballs just zero in on her every time. And it's one of those reasons I feel like there's got to be so much like B-roll and stuff from making this film, because every actor involved is so good at improv and so good at just rolling with a scene. How many outtakes must there be? Like, I would watch movie length outtakes, alternate cuts, different line reads from every character in this film.
To mention, it's an interesting movie, too, in that in another movie, I might have thought, oh, it's weird how it does this and that. And in this movie, everything just works, including the fact that really it's like a weirdly balanced three-act thing, because really, like, the first largest chunk is... We're in Mount Rose. We get to know everybody. We go to the pageant. It's very clear the Lehmans have always managed to rule there. It's that thing we've talked about before, too, of how weird it is. Although, granted, they've always lived there, so they don't have their sights on anything else, nor could they. But, like, that thing we have, like, why do people choose to be, like, the kings of a garbage place? Like, that's
right.
Where they want to be.
It's a roadhouse thing.
And like, yeah, exactly. It's the road. It's Ben Gazzara's roadhouse. It's like, why is that his plan? And for them, it's like, they rule this town. And they obviously have money. But that's all they got. It's like, they rule this town. And all she wants is to vicariously live through her daughter and get that victory in the pageant. So you know the whole thing is twisted and fixed, either with murder or other things, to get her there, to get Becky there. And, of course, we're following Amber. But then the second, very shorter act is when we move on from that to the next stage. And then there's, like, a tiny final act of that resolution. But it's very weird how it's structured, and yet it all just flows perfectly at the end.
Well, that's another beat too, that's kind of like that slasher beat. Like, we, since it is October, have been watching a lot of series, and this whole weekend actually we were watching a lot of the Friday the 13th movies. And it's one of the things that gets talked about a lot whenever they do like documentaries, interviews about the original Friday the 13th, where they said, wouldn't it be interesting where like you think it's the end of the movie and everything's calm and she's in the canoe and then suddenly like, bang, here's a music sting and something else has happened. You know, the kid pulling her into the water and then she wakes up in the hospital and like, you're like, oh, the end of the movie wasn't quite the end of the movie. It's kind of the same here,
right,
where, you know, people are dying, they're getting maimed. Amber's mom gets blown up and gets a beer can fused to her hand. It's like they get a light dropped on someone's head, which if that sounds familiar in reference to Ellen Barkin, they just did that in the episode of Poker Face she was on that we talked about, where somebody has a light almost fall on them on a stage. I can't believe that that wasn't an homage to Drop Dead Gorgeous. But, you know, you have all this stuff happening. A boy who is more interested in Amber than in Becky gets shot in the head while hunting. And Amber's got to fix him up because she works at the funeral parlor doing hair and makeup on the dead, which is another great sort of weird horror touch to this, that you actually do spend a lot of time in the, like, cold room at a mortuary.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all this stuff going on, and all the culmination of that is the big parade to celebrate Becky having been crowned, you know, the Mount Rose American Teen Princess, except because her parents are always cutting corners and, like, buying things on the black market, the swan float that her mother designed to sort of celebrate her and covered in sparklers like a glistening lake, it explodes dramatically. And, you know, you think, wow, here's the big, like, sort of finale of this. And then you realize there's still, like, a good half hour movie left here. Like, what's going to happen after this?
Also, by the way, the whole parade sequence reminds me of a few other things, including Student Bodies, which you couldn't finish watching.
It's a little too POV for me.
Which is itself a slasher comedy. And it's like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That every time I see that part of Drop Dead Gorgeous, I always think of Student Bodies because that kind of thing happens. Yeah, and I mean, the level of quotability is something that I think is always a key to something becoming a favorite, and a cult favorite in particular. And there's so many fantastic turns of phrase. It's so well written, but also everybody delivers stuff. Like, right down to little characters. I'm not bothering to look up every person, but, like, every time they cut to the two guys who are the local cops, I think about them constantly.
Constantly putting skull just in their cheek.
It's always, because whatever's going on, obviously they've been paid off already by the Lehmans.
Or they're just that dumb.
Or they're just stupid.
Yeah.
And, like,
I could go either way. I'm 50-50. Yeah,
and the one in front who's being interviewed is always doing the, after some careful investigation, we found there's just faulty wiring or something. But my favorite is his partner, who's always standing, like, halfway into the background, like he's waiting to leave. Like, you got to talk to the camera again. It's like, oh, we got to talk to the documentary people. But he's probably already thinking about lunch. And I just love how completely uninvested they are in their job or anything. And it's a lot of that kind of thing.
And then you get the opposite side of that, which is the guy who runs the funeral home where Amber works, who also is kind of like a grandfather figure to her. It's like, it's clear the town loves Amber and everyone kind of looks after her. The dance instructor takes care of her.
And everybody hates Becky.
Everybody hates Becky. And he, like, comes in to get her right after their trailer dramatically explodes. And he's the opposite end of it. He is, like, dramatically overacting to the point where now this is a line that you and I say to each other all the time around the house, where he walks in and he's like, there's been a fire, where it's like, he's Shatner. He's going full Shatner on these lines and he's going to deliver them. And it works. It's like, there's just something about it that doesn't feel forced. Like, every character feels right for who the character is.
So we just looked it up and found out the funeral director's name is Tom Gilshannon.
And this is it. This is all he's ever been in. I'm guessing maybe he was local. They did have a lot of, like, local people to where they were filming who were, like, background actors, especially when they get to the actual pageant in the school gym. Everybody, for the most part, who filled up the gym was just a local resident who got to be a background actor in it. In fact, so local that the way the story goes on set is that when Denise Richards performs her talent, which involves dancing around on stage with a giant felt cutout of Jesus on the cross, which makes me laugh hysterically every time she rolls across the stage with it on wheels, all the locals were so upset by it, they had to clear out the gym while she performed it. They couldn't film her scene with a crowd because they were just not having it. That's how local they were. Which is unfortunate, because it is hilarious, and I feel like not actually that offensive, because, gosh, she loves him, like, a lot. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Also, should mention Alexandra Holden, who plays Mary, who is the previous year's winner, who's gone through quite a lot to make herself fit the standards of beauty that we force upon people, and it's left her seriously damaged medically.
2 weeks until the pageant. I was practicing my talent, finishing my costume, brushing up on current events, and running 18 miles a day on about 400 calories. I was ready.
I always feel like it must be a very difficult thing to cast someone who is intended to be playing on film a person with an eating disorder, because you have to cast someone who you know and can confirm is actually a healthy individual if you're being responsible as a filmmaker. But then also it means that this is someone who is healthy but has to explain to people how, yeah, I know it looks like I have issues here, I'm sickly, or...
But also it's that sort of idea sometimes, I imagine, too, on the other side of it, where it's like you're casting someone and kind of telling them, we think you look like someone who's suffering from an eating disorder.
Like, how do you write the casting call?
And that's why we want you.
Yeah, I mean, she looks like something between someone who has an eating disorder and somebody who's just been really sick for a really long time. You know, somebody who's been bedridden. And I don't think enough credit is given to people who play roles like that. And that includes people who play roles in films where they have like a terminal illness, and like they're dying. And it's like, but the actor isn't. And so they have to be able to find a way to look like they have no strength left in their body to be able to even lift their arms.
Oh, I don't want to necessarily get too incredibly serious about it, because the main core of it, this is that it's a really sharply written, dark comedy. But something occurs to me. I was looking up some stuff because I thought you might be interested to know too, and everybody, about sort of the journey it took to be a cult favorite and where it stands now. For one thing, Allison Janney has said that she gets approached by fans of this far more than for appearing on West Wing, which tells you a lot about what really is going on out there as far as what people think of it and how many people are aware of it and watching it. And then also, just so we remember, because you said the time that it came on, everybody who was a fan was so celebrating, it's finally available. And then as quickly, I don't know why, it disappeared again. It was in 2019, right on the 20th anniversary, it came out on Hulu.
But, and then HBO Max for a while.
But then it disappeared. And what's interesting, though, is then I saw several writers, including some critics at The New Yorker and Teen Vogue and others, have written about how its slow discovery on VHS and DVD was by teenage girls who identified with its truthfulness and particular brand of dark humor. And the contemporary reviews of the time, all of which are quoted from people like Roger Ebert and, you know, a whole list of other men, is that dark humor sometimes hits but misses the target. Fitfully amusing that would have got a lot of mileage from just a tad more subtlety, says Dennis Harvey of Variety. And then meanwhile, decades later, women writing in Teen Vogue and The New Yorker and The Guardian and The Independent and E! News and everywhere else are saying, we've always loved this and we've discovered it, and it's truthful and absurdist, but also real. And it occurs to me that recently you also introduced me to the movie Now and Then, which features, remind me again, Christina Ricci, Gabby Hoffman,
Thor Birch.
And I can't remember now the one, there was the fourth one, and then know that
she
died tragically and she didn't get to have a very long career. And
I'm
can't
so
remember
sorry,
her name.
I don't know her name
okay.
either.
We're sorry about
it's
that.
It's also
too.
Got Devin Sawa in it.
Yeah, I'm not going to start looking everybody up now. But the thing is, it's like many people, even in trying to be nice to it, always apparently characterize it as, oh, Now and Then is the female version of Stand By Me.
Which isn't true.
Which is not really true. And I used to be a big fan of Stand By Me. And it's not really true. But also, even if it is true, it's a horrible thing to praise a movie by trying to define it through another film in that way. And also, that's a movie where apparently it didn't do that well. And then over the years, it was found by women who was like, this really hits home. And what occurs to me is, There's a really solid explanation here for why Drop Dead Gorgeous is considered a quote-unquote cult favorite and not just a great movie. It focuses on women, and it tells a truthful but very satirical story, and men watched it and thought, well, that's not interesting.
Especially because most of the men in the movie are absolute morons.
So, true to life. And I think you see a pattern emerge where it's like, well, that's why these movies are constantly overlooked, because we have a patriarchal system that's going to always rate them lower simply because it tried to center women in the story. If they'd done this about like a sports competition with a bunch of young guys in a small town, mm-hmm. I guarantee you this movie would be on top 10 lists all the time for like, this is a movie you got to see.
We've talked about this a lot too, in that there's just a lot of stuff that I never knew wasn't well received critically, because I have never cared about the critical response to something. Like, I've never gone to the movies because I was like, oh, the critics said this was good. I only ever go because I want to see something. And so there really is that pattern of like, this is something that like I discovered like right at the start of college. And so I wasn't quite like a teen discovering it, but kind of like 18, 19, close enough. And like, it has really been a huge part of what kind of shaped my sense of humor as an adult. Like, there's other stuff that really shaped my sense of humor as a teen. Daria in particular, like coming really right before this, was had a huge impact on me. Now and Then right before that had a huge impact on me. And it's fascinating because if any of these things were released in an era of internet and social media being what it is now, I really think things would have hit differently. Because, yeah, like, there is, for better or for worse, right? We're not going to spend a lot of time dissecting the good and the bad of the internet, because there's a lot to talk about. But there has been, at least to a certain sense, like a certain extent, the ability for people who didn't have a voice in these very rigid, like, review systems, a chance to have their voices heard if people kind of key into it and hear what they're saying. So people always talk about like the democratization of the web, and there were a couple years where it worked really well, and now we're kind of just back in a bog. It's like, because it existed at a time and was released at a time where the media narrative was just so like tightly controlled. And there were only a few ways you could hear about something, in terms of like the critics maybe print something in the paper. Maybe it's that you watched the weekly show and you saw what like Siskel and Ebert said. And Ebert really ripped this one apart. If you go on YouTube, you can find the...
You saw that?
I've watched it. You can watch his review of Drop Dead Gorgeous. And it makes me want to punch the screen every time I see it, because I'm like, it's not for you.
Yeah, right.
This movie is not for you. And I'm finding a whole pattern of this, of movies that I've loved growing up that were panned by people they weren't created for. All of them stories centered around women, in particular teen girls. So that includes Now and Then. That includes Drop Dead Gorgeous. That includes Sugar and Spice, which if you haven't seen, you should absolutely see it, because it is brilliant. It is funny, and it is biting, and it is such an amazing satire and a commentary as well on like how we treat teen girls as well. I mean, she's a great sort of window to the world of what it is to be a teen girl. I would also say Stick It, which I've shown you, which is a gymnastics competition movie, is a great example of that as well. A bunch of people who were kind of about to have careers in other ways, especially television, started out there. And that movie was not exactly well received, but it also has been essentially a quote unquote cult favorite. And every time you hear this, it's because they resonate with women and often resonate with the gay community as well, because these are movies that are about feeling different and feeling like awkward or like out of place where you are. And like Drop Dead Gorgeous is one I think we saw has been like shown a lot at like movie nights at like drag bars and things like that.
I think that's one of the things also that's very nice about Drop Dead Gorgeous is how it's funny. It can also mean something very deep at the same time, but I'm not saying they necessarily thought that with the same degree of consciousness as their desire to make a nice comedy. But obviously there's a lot of meaning that goes along with it. And also the fact that everybody participating in the contest, even if some of them might be what you would consider conventionally attractive or attractive by a certain basic standard, they're all weird or outsiders or strange in some way that makes them seem like you wouldn't immediately expect them to be in this pageant or that they might not be really likely to win.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like rooting for everybody except Becky.
Everybody except Becky.
We're rooting for everybody on a certain level because you're hoping their lives will work out better than the town they're in and where they're coming from. And they all seem, actually almost all of them apart from the Lehmans, all seem like basically nice people.
Who
care for each other. And that also is demonstrated in a great, like, late moment where they've basically orchestrated it so that Amber can't do her talent performance because they made up some ridiculous rule about the costumes and everybody kind of rallies. They, like,
hid her outfit and steal it. And,
They rally around her and the other girls figure out a solution so that she... And it's like everybody is together and they're nice and they want to get out of this town and have a life. What's the line? The boys have a chance by like getting like sports scholarship.
Or guys get out of Mount Rose all the time for hockey scholarships or prison.
That's it. Yeah.
I can do the whole movie verbatim, by the way. So if you have a question about a line, you just let me know.
You just do it.
But also that whole bit where everybody rallying around Amber because they want her to be able to perform. They know that she's the most talented among them as well. Like she tap dances and like, I mean, full disclosure, her tap dancing is not like the world's greatest tap dancing, but also she works hard. She has talent. She's passionate about dancing and she's definitely the most talented out of all of them. She's with good. A traditional skill.
She's good and she would probably get better, but also the implication pretty strongly, she's probably going to stay in like television news when she finally gets into that.
So, I mean, they rally around her and they decide, you know what? Brittany Murphy gives her her costume.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lisa's like, you know what? I'm dropping out of the pageant. My costume's approved. Amber's going to wear my costume. There's nothing you can do about it. And I can't do it justice, so I will not replicate it. But that act of kindness leads to one of the world's absolute best line deliveries with her father outside the pageant scolding her for having quit and telling her that her brother never would have done something like this. And if you know the movie as well as we do, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's just, it's one of the greatest line reads I've ever heard. And also, I mean, really, such a loss, like, creatively, Brittany Murphy having died so young. Yeah. She's so extraordinarily talented at everything, like comedy, drama, action. But she also really, really does such amazing line reads in every part of the spectrum here, right? Like, the one I just talked about is like a really extreme passionate line read. But then she has these little throwaway lines that are like almost under her breath, like an aside where like she's talking to Amber and she's like, aren't your parents going to be upset? And she's like, no, you know, they only had me because Peter needed that kidney. And it's just like, it's, and she just says it kind of just like that, like, eh. Like she's just resigned to it. And it's just, it's chef's kiss. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like everyone does a beautiful job and they're never out of character. Like they're always committed to the character they've developed for this.
It's the little touches. Everybody in this is doing so much work. Like you talked about bits of business and other things too. What is it? Is it Janelle is the one who's doing sign language?
Yeah.
And there's that little extra yeah she'll put in some lines where she'll say something. Yeah. And it's like, she's fantastic. Her body language and everything, just amazing. It's just an incredible collection of people. It's one of those things. It's like, we've talked about this. I'm pretty sure we've talked about this before with like favorite films where sometimes it's just, you can't predict it. It's just everybody, they picked everybody right. Everybody came to the set, and the exact combination of everybody involved made a nearly perfect movie.
Something and, just happened.
And it just happened that way. And you can't predict how that's going to happen.
10 Things I Hate About You is another one that people talk about like that. And every actor who worked on that film said that basically the ensemble cast, they were getting along well, and that Heath Ledger, another person who
yeah,
gone way sooner than he should have been. And apparently he showed up to set at 10 Things I Hate About You, and it was like the last piece of the puzzle. And
I remember
like, the whole cast just gelled in a way where like they're all still friends to this day and like still talk about what an amazing set experience it was. And I feel like Drop Dead Gorgeous was that same sort of vibe, minus Kirstie Alley, who apparently they all hated working with. Because,
yeah.
I mean, she thought she was better than everyone else.
Good reason.
And that creates some tension on a set.
But again, sadly, she was actually also good. So,
well, what are you going
to
do?
She did what she had to do as the awful
person. I think it's
also
worth pointing out that you realize very quickly when you do the math that she talks about how 17 years ago she was Mount Rose American Teen Princess. And it's a pageant for 17-year-old girls, which means she got pregnant when she was 17 and probably forced Lester to marry her. And who knows if Becky's even his kid. Like not clear on that, and it's sort of like a nice little touch where they say it without saying it. There's a lot of stuff written into the script and the subtext between the lines, which I love. And it's sort of one of those things where you start to realize as you get towards the end of it, yeah, this is a dark comedy. Yeah, it's about a teen beauty pageant, but man, the bodies are piling up by the end of it.
Yeah.
And it really, to me, is like, this is why you could argue this is a slasher. And I think it would put it in a whole new category and on a whole lot more radar for people if, like, when, like, streaming services and stuff put together, here are our October lists of horror movies, and they always go, like, here's movies with strong women, here's movies that are slashers, classics, like this and that. This should be on those lists. It should be on those slasher lists. It's a slasher comedy. It should be right up there with some of the other ones that we've seen. Like you were talking about, like Student Bodies. Like
I should also mention, if we get too far away from it, that Brittany Murphy, we talked about her before and probably a little less flatteringly, but charitably so because we've always loved her.
Yeah.
We talked about real early on in Ghouls in the House. We did Cherry Falls that she did. And at that point in her career, I remember we talked about like something was off in the way she was acting and the movie, of course, had its issues. We talked about all that in that
episode. Don't see Cherry Falls. That's not worth watching.
But obviously we weren't criticizing her in the sense that we knew something was obviously wrong there. But in this, it's at her peak where she's just fantastic along with everybody.
And not only do the bodies pile up in this one, they keep piling up right into the end credits where it's like you get to see Amber starts her journalism career because Kirstie Alley escapes prison and decides she's going to take out Amber, and she's in this like seed shoot off outside the chicken shack or something. Like she's like above a grocery store and she's taking pot shots into the crowd. Like a reporter gets hit and Amber just catches the microphone and just steps right in.
This is Amber Adkins reporting live from the food check. KRLH News. One of our reporters has just been shot. Paramedics are working on you right now.
And it's one of the truly great examples of fixing something that should not have been that way the first time. Because as we found out, the original cut of the movie, that final sequence, it was a different character up on the roof of that
the
building.
Librarian.
The librarian that we see earlier explaining Ludafisk and how she had once been in the pageant apparently snaps, but it has no resonance compared to her, Kirstie Alley's character, doing it. And they went back and reshot those few little bits and it makes it perfect.
Yeah.
And as far as bodies piling up through to the end credits, there's certainly her like killing spree at the end. And she's got to have at least hit a few people.
We don't know what she did to get out of prison. So, yeah. But
the part that always makes my heart sink, but it's too good a movie and too funny that by that point it doesn't depress me too much, but it's just so hurtful. And you've all seen it, so it doesn't matter. Full spoilers is that we never know what happened to Amy Adams.
She just disappears.
Because at the end, when they do that typical like Animal House and other kind of thing, we get the text on the screen about this is where this person wound up, and we find out that she became an exotic dancer and she was last seen in the Philippines, I think it was.
Yep.
And if anybody knows where she is, it's like she was kidnapped or murdered and no one knows where she is.
Also, Harold, who is one of the judges of the pageant and runs the general store, he dies from a tick bite.
A tick bite.
And like leaves the store to Hank.
Which is Will Sasso. And that final shot is just like everything else, brilliance. Everything Will Sasso does in this is naturally incredibly funny and very physical. Yeah, it's just amazing. There's so many little bits and pieces that we could obviously talk about, but it would become that thing of just a parade of here's my other favorite line.
Right. Yeah, I'm not even kidding when I say I could just give you the script from memory, probably including the stage direction. But, you know, obviously I'm not going to subject you to that. But it also is such a testament to the film that, like, there are so many lines that we can say to each other just to make the other person laugh, like, mm-hmm. in any given situation. And there's a few other things that we do that from, and other little bits and, like, YouTube sketches and films and things like that.
We certainly built up a catalog of Mystery Science Theater and Riff Track riffs.
But this is one of those movies, too. It also basically is the only accent that I can reliably do. I'm not good at accents. I don't know. Every time I try to do one, it devolves. When I did theater, I did props and costumes. I was not on stage. It was not my skill.
When you try to do a British accent, it usually sounds like somebody trying to be a Cockney chimney sweep boy. In a bad local play.
I joke that every
accent... Which is great.
Yeah, I mean, every accent I try to do eventually becomes the Swedish chef from The Muppet Show.
That's true, which is fine.
Unless I am doing a Minnesotan accent, in mm-hmm. which case, you know, it's just what you do. There's just so much about it that's, like, quotable in a way that just lifts your mood. And I think that is, like, some of the greatest praise that you can give to a movie. It's not just that, oh, it's a great commentary, or the writing's good, or the acting's great, or the score was fantastic, or, you know, it really made me think about some things. It's that this movie, and thinking about this movie and quoting this movie, and I'm hoping maybe just by virtue of talking about it on the podcast, like, getting more people to watch this movie just genuinely makes me feel happy. And that is really rare thing, and it's hard to come by, especially for something that apparently, according to the critics, isn't really all that good.
Thanks for listening to Ghouls in the House, featuring Natalie Bielatowski and Arnold T. Blumberg. You can find Natalie on Threads at Positively Natalie, and me at Doctor of the Dead. Our movie this episode, our 50th, was Drop Dead Gorgeous from 1999.
Who are you? Just like that.
Ghouls in the House is an ATV Publishing production. Check out our other podcasts, books on your favorite fictional worlds, and other assorted goodies at www.atvpublishing.com.
Get you a root beer float.
Okay.
You guys want some shots? I'm buying.